On a cold evening in January of 1999, Tika Lewis's parents took their two-year-old for a night of bowling.
Her mother left Tika playing on an arcade game for just a moment while she took her turn bowling.
When she looked back, her daughter had vanished.
Welcome back to Missing. I am Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
Doing pretty well. How are you today?
I am doing well. And for this episode, we have our friend and coworker Jennifer Amell join us. And we're speaking about the disappearance of Tika Lewis from Tacoma, Washington on January 23rd, 1999.
Yeah, there's no two ways about it. This one is a really sad story, very tragic. She was only 2.5 years old when she went missing. And we said it during the interview, it's tough to read statistics of anybody who's missing, male, female, young, old. But when you describe somebody as being just 3 foot tall and 35 pounds at the time of their disappearance, it hits home in a way that the others don't, because just considering how helpless this incredibly young girl was. We also break down a lot of the other factors that went into this disappearance, this potential abduction, the location, the amount of people around there, the incredible immediate investigation, both from law enforcement and by the public, and still no answers. So really, this one could use the help of the public. This one could really use the help of the public raising the awareness and making sure that it doesn't disappear.
Absolutely. And this research was brought to us by Private Investigations for the Missing. You can get more information about that nonprofit that we are on the board of at investigationsforthemissing.org. And this research was done by volunteer Kathleen Studer. So thanks a lot, Kathleen. This is great work. And you're right, Lance. This one could really use the help of the public. So the Tacoma Police Department is the investigating agency. Their phone number is 253-798-4721. And the FBI is also still involved in this. So if you have any information, you could also reach out to your local FBI office.
And as far as we know, the detective assigned to this from the Tacoma Police Department is Larry Lindberg. So if you're contacting the Tacoma Police Department, be sure to reference Larry Lindberg.
Okay, part two will be coming next week. Thanks a lot for listening. Please follow us on social media at MissingCSM.
And while you're listening to the shows, feel free to swing on over to your favorite podcast listening service and throw down a 5-star review. Throw us one. Give us one.
We really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Welcome back to the podcast, Jennifer Amell. How are you today, Jen?
I'm doing very well, Tim. Thank you.
It's really good to have you on because I feel like I need you on this episode. Not like I can get through it with just Tim, but having you on this episode as we talk about the disappearance of a very, very, very young individual, Tika Lewis. She disappeared in 1999 and she was 2.5 years old. And just the first few details of her as a person, just the description of her, is heartbreaking. And then you get into the actual disappearance. I am grateful to have somebody on who we can sort of have an emotional round table with.
This case is really heartbreaking. I mean, every missing persons case that we cover, like, touches us in some kind of way, but it's particularly hard when it is such a young person.
Absolutely. You know, what's the alternative, right? Do you read it straight? Do you wear that emotion while you read it? It's tough. We were just talking about just getting through the details just to get to the story, and it's a lot easier to focus on the investigation in a case like this. Jennifer, this research was done by a new researcher. Can you tell us who that was?
Yes, we have a fantastic new researcher who's volunteering her time for private investigations for the missing. Her name is Kathleen Studer.
Well, thanks a lot, Kathleen, for putting this together. It couldn't have been easy, but it's so thorough. I think we had talked about this possibly being a two-parter just due to how thorough this is.
Thanks a lot for volunteering, Kathleen. We really appreciate it. You can check out more information about private investigations for the missing at investigationsforthemissing.org.
And to run down some of the statistics on Tika Lewis, she's been missing since January 23rd of 1999, missing from the New Frontier Lanes, that's in Tacoma, Washington, specifically at a location 4702 Center Street. The bowling alley does not exist any longer, but that was the address where she was last known to be seen. She was born on July 4th, 1996, a biracial female, that's African American, Caucasian, and Chippewa, black hair, brown eyes, again, 2.5 years old. She was 3 feet tall, 35 pounds. Clothing at the time of missing, a green Tweety Bird sweatshirt, white sweatpants, black and white Air Jordan sneakers, and a clear purse with a fish design containing quarters and Starburst.
Jeez, that's really heartbreaking just to read what she was carrying around in her little purse. It's such a 2.5-year-old thing to have. Quarters and you Starburst.
You can see that purse, right, in your head, like that the clear plastic.
Yeah.
It's the Tweety Bird sweatshirt that gets me. That detail, it's just so innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And distinguishing characteristic, she had some skin discoloration on her face and buttocks, eczema, pierced ears, and may require medical attention for asthma. She's classified as lost, injured, or missing.
Tika is the fourth of five children born to Teresa English. Tika's father, his name is Robert Lewis, who is also the father to Tika's younger sister by about 1.5 years, named Tamika. Teresa was 27 years old at the time of Tika's disappearance, and Robert Lewis was actually incarcerated at the time of Tika's disappearance at McNeil Island Correctional Center. He was serving a 4-year sentence and is not considered a suspect in her disappearance.
And because Tika was so young at the time of her disappearance, obviously age progression images, renderings can be found out there. They actually did a pretty good job, which I believe was done by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. There's age progression of her at 15 and at 17, which physically, characteristically, looks pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, it always amazes me how age progression is done. Sometimes you see really bad ones. These do appear to be good ones. Obviously, we don't know what Tika looks like now, but seems like it could be accurate.
And these age progression images that we're speaking of, you can find on our social media platforms, Missing CSM, if you want to check them out and just kind of put a visual to what we're talking about here.
Okay, and the New Frontier Lanes Bowling Alley was located right off Highway 16 and not far from I-5 in the western part of the city of Tacoma. Formerly called Midway Bowl, it was renamed and reopened in 1961 as New Frontier Lanes, a 32-lane bowling alley, and the main entrance was in the middle of the building. It had an area that was open behind the bowling lanes with a counter for people who were watching the bowlers to sit at, which sounds kind of cool. Arcade games are on the wall in the open area as well as an arcade room. But it closed in July of 1999 and was demolished by a development company that built a Home Depot and Jack in the Box in that location.
Now, it's important to know the geography of the area and also the layout of the building, as you described, Tim, because as you'll see later on as we talk about the circumstances of that evening and her disappearance, where the lanes were that the family was bowling at, where she was in that arcade, and how close she was to the side door, how close she was to access outside, whether she did it herself or somebody grabbed her and brought her outside, how that lays out in the parking lot. Also, how close it was to Highway 16. It is literally right off the highway. So very important to know the geography and the layout.
Yeah, not to mention that I-5 intersected right at that junction, too. You could easily get on the interstate from there, too. And that's kind of a quick getaway. We see that a lot in various cases, like abductions or murders taking place, like right outside of an interstate highway. Just ease of access, I think.
So Tika and almost a dozen of her family members arrived at New Frontier at about 8:30 p.m. on Saturday night, January 23rd. 1999. Her mom, her babysitter, her mom, her baby sister, and her mom's boyfriend and uncles were some of who were there. Sounds like a big party. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, it was league night, and there was an estimated 150 people there who were just bowling. There was also about the same amount of people who were watching those individuals bowl. The parking lot was completely full, and with the sounds of the bowling happening and people gathering, you can imagine just how noisy and sort of chaotic the whole thing was.
The temperature that day was around 38 degrees Fahrenheit, and the area had just received over like half an inch of rain that day. Keep in mind, this is Washington, so it's not out of the ordinary for a lot of rainfall. Tika did not have a coat on at the time of her disappearance either.
And Tika's family and friends were bowling on lanes 7 and 8, which, you know, can be kind of important because, as we discussed, one of the entrances was right in the middle. So they were somewhat in the middle of a 32-lane bowling alley.
I think the layout of the bowling alley, I think they had lanes on both sides of the building with like kind of the food arcade area in the middle of it. And on the side that Tika's family was bowling on, they were in the middle lanes, 7 and 8. And at the end of that lane was a cluster of arcade games. And that's where Tika was sitting and occupying herself as her family was taking turns on the lanes.
And at the exact time of the incident, Tika was in that arcade area along the back wall, sitting in the seat of a car racing game called Cruisin' World. And she was too small to play the game, and her feet wouldn't even reach the pedals. And the game sat about 6 feet from a side exit door that opened up to the east side of the building.
And here's where the sightings break down. Around 10:15, Teresa was standing near Tika, but it was her turn to bowl. She asked her boyfriend to take over watching Tika. She said later that she told Tika she would be right back. It then became her boyfriend's turn to bowl, so Tika's uncle took over watching her. Tika's uncle turned to watch Teresa's boyfriend's roll, turned back to Tika, and discovered that she was gone. So this happened in the course of just a few minutes, from 10:15 to, I guess, maybe 10:20, a little past 10:20-ish.
Yeah, it's an amazingly narrow time frame for something to have happened. I mean, you hate to think that somebody was watching Tika's family looking for an opportunity to approach this small child. Or it could be that Tika just sort of wandered off from the arcade game within those minutes. But it's so tragic that, like, given this very narrow window of time when her whole family just turned around to watch bowling, that Tika disappeared.
And in the middle of a bunch of people as well. If someone was abducted, if a child was abducted, it had to have happened so fast that all of the bystanders, the onlookers, the bowlers, and including the three people that were assigned to watch Tika never saw. You know, it's whoever abducted her, or if she decided to walk away, she took the prime opportunity to do so. And it seems to me like they did as much due diligence as they could have, at least from their accounts, to watch Tika. That, you know, they were there to bowl, their turns came up, and they made sure that somebody was watching the girl.
Yeah, whatever happened must have happened quick, and it is every parent's worst nightmare. And Tika's family spent 10 or so minutes frantically looking for her around the bowling alley, searching behind the arcade games and the bathrooms and anywhere she might have gone, including out into the parking lot through that side exit door and yelling Tika's name. And Teresa said that Tika was a mama's girl who didn't like the dark and would have come to her mother's calling if she heard her. And she also states that she felt the side door was too heavy for Tika to have pushed open by herself.
I mean, it's a great point. It's a great bit of speculating or theorizing by Teresa. I can't get into the mind of a 2.5-year-old little girl, but being in an area where your family is and there's fun happening and you're at an arcade game, and even though you're too small to play the game, you're still there. It's like bright lights. There's a lot of activity. It makes no sense why she would force a door open. And even though it's unlocked, like, that's a heavy door. Like, there, it's a side door probably with one of those crash bars. It would take a bit of an effort, I would imagine. Why would she even decide to leave that environment to go out into 20 degree weather with no jacket?
Yeah, I think the circumstances definitely point to somebody maybe luring her out.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. And an off-duty Tacoma police officer was working security duty that night and was notified that Tika was missing about 10 minutes after she went missing. And the bowling alley made a loudspeaker announcement right after the officer was notified, and they asked all of the people in the bowling alley to stop what they were doing and help search for Tika.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, we always say when we do these episodes, like, why didn't this happen? Where was this person? Why did they wait so long? But this is not the case. This is the entire bowling alley shutting down and saying, stop what you're doing. We need to find this child. That's as much as they could do 10 to 15 minutes after a child could have just possibly wandered off. I think that that's reassuring that they shut it down and said, stop what you're doing and look for this child, because they could have just written it off and said she wandered off. You know, she's probably in another arcade game or something.
Yeah, I think, like, on the flip side of that, it probably becomes very difficult because there were so many people there. I mean, there's upwards of 300 people in this bowling alley that night. So if you're law enforcement and you're trying to, like, keep people inside, like, don't leave until you're questioned, I think that would be quite difficult with that many people.
Yeah. And Teresa described a woman at the bowling alley that night who asked to hold Teresa's relative's baby. And Teresa believes this woman could be a suspect. This part kind of reminds me of the disappearance of Raymond Green. We had his mom, Donna, on, and that is something similar that happened in that case. Donna had met a woman at the hospital and took her baby home, and this, you know, this woman who she thought was a friend was in her house while Donna went to take a shower. And when she got out of the shower, this woman and Raymond were gone.
And as a parent, I'm asking, as a parent, is it an instant red flag when a stranger asks to hold your baby?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I mean, unless you're at, like, a family reunion or something like that, a stranger? Yes. Yes. 100%.
In a bowling alley, there's nothing about that where you'd say, like, that's just an innocent, you know, child loving adult.
No, I mean, I don't think so, in my opinion.
Yeah, agreed. I think perhaps because it's a female, like, I think maybe you'd feel a little bit more uneasy if it were a male who was like, can I come over and hold your baby? But your guard is down a bit when it's a woman asking, because you have this, like, sense of maternal instinct and that, like, a woman could never hurt a child. But I mean, that's not always the case.
And I guess I kind of set myself up when I had mentioned how diligent the establishment was in trying to find Tika right away. As we'll discover going deeper into this conversation, they might have had another reason to locate a young child who was missing in their facility, that they might not want an event happening that had previously happened a couple of times, which we'll get to. I just want to put that out there, that maybe it wasn't so much, let's find this child for her safety, for the parents' safety. Maybe it was like, this has happened before.
Well, you're right that the establishment, you know, acted pretty quick. So maybe it was something that they were, I don't want to say used to have happening, but, you know, it wasn't the most unusual thing. They marked off the parking lot within 15 minutes of her going missing, and the search began right then and there.
I wonder if that's because they had an officer there already who was experienced in the protocol, like, what should happen right after a child goes missing. I wonder if that officer wasn't there, if they would have the same response.
That is a great point. That's a great point.
Yeah, it struck me as good luck that he was there, that officer, or he or she, I suppose, but also that he or she was there on security detail. So maybe this was the establishment sort of thinking ahead a little bit.
Well, there was an immediate search. For the next 15 hours, police, 33 search and rescue, which includes 8 canines, a helicopter with infrared camera. They all searched a 1.5 mile radius surrounding the bowling alley. So I'm guessing that they went like onto the highway and a little bit beyond the highway. It's not immediately reported to the news, but two dogs working were led to an overgrown area across the street right after she went missing. They did not locate anything of evidentiary value at the time, but 2 days later, they went back to that same area that the two dogs had alerted them to originally and located some men's clothing that was rolled up into a ball.
I'm wondering, like, why the dogs would have alerted to that. Like, would Tika's scent be on his clothing?
I guess it depends what kind of dogs, too.
Yeah, I'm wondering what would make the dogs alert to that rolled up ball of men's clothing. They obviously wouldn't have the scent of any strange man that happened upon the area. So I'm wondering if the scent of Tika was actually on that clothing.
I think it depends what kind of dogs were used. If they were search dogs and they gave a search dog a sniff of a piece of clothing that Tika, you know, wore, then that would be the reason. I think if it's a cadaver dog, then that's worse news. But I would think this was probably search dogs at this point.
Right. And if they introduced search dogs to all of this, it goes without saying, they provided articles of Tika's clothing so that the dogs had a scent of the person that they were searching for. But bear in mind that they didn't locate anything during that initial search when the dogs were led to that area. So maybe Tika had been right there for a brief period of time, maybe a couple hours, and left her scent at that area, at that location, before being taken away. I don't know if we can equate the scent being on those clothes. They went back without the dogs to that area for a further search and found the clothes the second time.
Right. So you're saying like the clothes might be a red herring. They just happened to be in the area where Tika was.
Could be a red herring, or maybe they didn't see them the first time around, but I don't think the dogs would have been searching arbitrarily. I think if they were alerted to a location, it wasn't a false alarm, and her scent at one point had been there.
Yeah, let's give you a little bit more detail about what this clothing consists of. It was a Boatworks navy blue wool coat. This was a size large. There were initials on the label, either an IS or a JS, which, thanks to the help of a tipster, was later determined to be the codes used by a local thrift store by the name of Value Village. There was also Lee Dungarees off-white jeans. They were a size 34 waist and a 32 length. There was a Columbia button-down flannel shirt. There's no size indicated, but it was blue and green over white with yellow plaid. It was determined that the clothing had not been there that long because it had no mold, which, as you might remember, we're in the Pacific Northwest. It's very damp, so I think that would quickly get relatively moldy if it had been there for long.
And forensics apparently combed the clothing for fibers and evidence, but it was never reported, publicly at least, if there were any findings.
I wonder how long the police had a presence in that area in those hours. In the day or two after, you know, I'm saying like if those clothes weren't there during the first search, who had the opportunity to put them there without the police noticing if the police were still searching or if there were still even locals, volunteers searching?
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. I wonder how someone could slip into that area if it was kind of crawling with search and rescue personnel.
It's also impressive that four FBI agents on Sunday, the 24th, the day after the disappearance, four FBI agents were assigned to the case along with the Tacoma Police Department.
Yeah, and they started interviewing and backgrounding patrons and employees of the bowling alley, as well as asking anyone who took photos to please turn them in. And they checked phone records of the payphones at the alley for clues, and they checked with local sex offenders. It was determined, unfortunately, that the surveillance system was not working the night of January 23rd, so there was no video to help with the investigation, which is completely frustrating. And I hate hearing that kind of thing. I feel like that happens all the time in these cases that we cover. Like, oh, the battery wasn't working or the thing was down or something like that. It's just frustrating. Please check your tapes, everybody.
Any theories about why the FBI was so quickly involved in this?
I think they jump on any case where it's this young of a missing person.
Yeah. Kidnapping of a child. And also the area. It's not the most uncommon thing in that area.
Yeah, because we know, like with other missing persons of adults that go missing, like there's always the question there if they could have willingly left their life behind. But with a child, you know, that's definitely not a possibility.
Yeah, if she walked away on her own, she'd be found somewhere. And that's just the reality. We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
Antika's family also brought a psychic into the investigation, the first psychic into the investigation, very quickly on that Sunday, January 24th. And so there's several psychics associated with the case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if this speaks to the belief system of the Lewis family, but I think it definitely speaks to the state of mind of a parent who's missing their child. They will try anything to get information about their kid's whereabouts.
Right. The hopelessness of the situation, the helpless feeling that they, I'm sure, feel. Yeah. You're right. You'd turn anywhere. Not sure how helpful psychics are going to be at that point, but I guess it can't hurt that much at that point. I don't know.
Yeah, it can't hurt that much. And in addition to that, it wasn't like they were getting no attention from law enforcement. As we said, the FBI was involved, and now there's 11 FBI agents assigned to it. There's 32 Tacoma Police Department officers assigned to it. And on Monday, the 25th, they go door to door in the area. They're interviewing potential witnesses. Teresa English takes a voluntary polygraph, her first one. And at that time, approximately 120 tips have come into the tip line. So we're talking 2 days later.
Yeah, this is a massive search effort. And I think by this point, the news outlets have probably picked up this story. And that's why they're getting so many tips in about this case.
And I also want to note that Teresa took two polygraphs. Both of them have not been publicly revealed. The results have not been publicly revealed.
That's a lot of tips to have come in, and at least they have a lot of officers and FBI agents working on it, so they could potentially even handle that amount of tips. It's really hard, I would imagine, to handle that amount of tips. And on Tuesday, January 26th, 50 volunteers from KUBE-FM, which is a local radio station, searched a three-mile radius from the bowling alley, and search and rescue dragged a pond near the bowling alley, but not finding any clues.
And then by Wednesday, which would be the 27th, Teresa takes her second polygraph to address several questions that weren't considered in the first polygraph. As Lance mentioned, both of these polygraphs have not been made public, the results of which.
But law enforcement does not consider Teresa a suspect.
And the first candlelight vigil is held on that Sunday, a little over a week later, at the bowling alley. Approximately 500 tips at that time had been received.
Yeah, and it was reported on February the 3rd that a psychic led police to an area just east of the Fort Lewis Army Base. They searched the area but found nothing. This psychic was able to lead police to the body of a girl that was missing in 1996, so that's why the police kind of took this psychic up and followed their lead. But by the first week of February, 550 tips had come in and 300 people had been interviewed. Even with all of these tips and all of these interviews, police did not have a suspect. And Detective Fiardo stated, Tika vanished into thin air.
Well, that's not true. And I'd like to know more information about the psychic that led police to the body of a girl that was missing in 1996. And to my knowledge, this would be one of the only documented cases of something like that happening. So, yeah, I would like a little more info on that. That's interesting.
I realize that the detective who made that comment, she vanished into thin air, probably didn't realize what the gravity of saying something like that is when that detective said it. But reading it just on paper and hearing it later on, someone verbalizing it, it really gives you the sense that hope has been lost when someone in law enforcement makes a comment that isn't based in reality. You know, she disappeared into thin air. Like you said, Tim, that didn't happen. No one disappears into thin air. It's a figure of speech. probably didn't mean it, definitely didn't mean it in that way, but should have been a little more selective when delivering quotes to the media.
Yeah, you're right. And I really mean to be hard on the detective, in saying that it's not true. And I think, to your point, it's a great point, actually, that law enforcement just doesn't say things like that unless this is something that they have no trace of.
Yeah, it's a very disheartening comment. I can't imagine being Tika's family and reading or listening to something like that. It's like, well, she didn't, yeah, so
that's a great
go
point.
Back and do your job.
No, you're right. I would be furious, to be honest. Yeah. As a human being, I mean, that kind of is probably his or her experience investigating the case.
Definitely. So let's go through some of these tips. Not many of them were made known to the public, but 1 year after Tika went missing, at the time of the first annual candlelight vigil, it was revealed that one of the tips was from a 17-year-old that was at the bowling alley that night and saw two men standing near a girl around the time Tika disappeared. This teenager stated that it looked like they were following her. This teenager described them as one man being between 30s and 40s, about 5'11", 200 pounds, with brown hair and a thick mustache and a pockmarked face and a big nose. That seems like a memorable person to me. The other guy was also between 30s and 40s, who was about 5'9", 200 pounds, with long black hair, dirty jeans, and a gray jacket with a sports logo. I'm not sure if these two men have ever been tracked down. I'm sure police got a good handle on who all was there at the bowling alley that night, because I mean, there were so many people, I suppose it would be easy for these two men to slip out unnoticed, especially before the alarm was raised. But I do wonder if they were ever located.
Yeah, the pockmarked face is an interesting characteristic. I had to look that up, and it's sort of like like craters in your face a little bit, maybe from chicken pox. Is that probably where the term comes from?
Yeah. Typically it's from like a pox, like smallpox, chicken pox, but chicken pox is usually when you get the scars.
Yeah, or like terrible acne too will lead to that.
But it's really interesting that if someone can pick up on that, it either speaks to the teenager's really incredible wherewithal, like sense of where he is. And it really speaks to the teenager's presence, his wherewithal. Either the pockmarks were so bad that he noted them instantly, or he was close enough to see it. A combination of those two, and then remember it and be able to make that description, right down to like a large nose, a thick mustache. Like there's something about this person that stood out where he cataloged the details.
I wonder how soon after Tika's disappearance that this witness statement was taken. I mean, if it was the day after or even the night of, then I would definitely give this some credence. Like, I imagine that I would notice too, like two men who don't necessarily look like Tika, who are paying her attention or even following her. I would definitely remember a scene like that.
For sure. It sounds like a pretty good tip. And it sounds like it wasn't really made public that this was information until a year later. So you're right. This tip could have come in at any point between Tika's disappearance and a year later. So I would say the earlier the better on that, obviously. And another tip revealed at that same time from a woman arriving at the bowling alley at about 10:15, which was the time that Tika disappeared. She noted that a 1980s to 90s maroon four-door Pontiac Grand Am with tinted windows and a spoiler on the back speeding out of the parking lot. Unfortunately, she was unable to get a license plate.
Yeah, and we're not really sure why these tips took a year to be released and why no suspect sketches were ever completed. As we'll see in a bit, this information was released to the news media about a year later, but it was not mentioned again until 20 years later when a new detective assigned to the case in 2020 brings it back into focus. I imagine that, I mean, law enforcement does this all the time, right? They hold back information to see if they can get another witness to corroborate it, if they also saw those two men, if they also saw that Pontiac Grand Am. But I imagine if in a year they didn't hear any corroborating stories, that they would deem it safe to release to the news.
And the investigation continues, but unfortunately goes cold. The reward for information regarding the disappearance of Tika eventually grew to its current total of $27,000. The Tacoma Police Department and the FBI ran parallel investigations, one focusing on the family and one on strangers, which is, again, reassuring to me that they were working hand in hand with the police department and saying, we'll work on this, you work on this. During this time, there were reports of sightings of individuals that looked like Tika. Unfortunately, none of them were her. She was highlighted on America's Most Wanted three separate times in 1999, January 30th, February 6th, and September 4th, which, again, is very impressive to me.
And on May 10th in 2001, it is reported that there was a body of a young African-American girl found in Kansas City. And Teresa didn't feel like it was Tika, and about 2 months later, DNA ruled Tika out of being that Jane Doe, and the body was referred to as Precious Doe. Precious Doe is eventually identified several years later as Erica Michelle Marie Green, a three-year-old child. And her mother and stepfather were later convicted of her murder.
Oh, God, that's horrible. It's important to mention here because, like, sometimes you would see in various articles or whatever that a Doe had been found in Kansas City and might be linked to her case, but we know that's not the case now. And then in the early 2000s, the property next to the bowling alley was developed. As we mentioned before, it became a Home Depot and a Jack in the Box. But the Tacoma police believed that Tika's body would be found as this area was excavated. But that property, as well as the property that the bowling alley was on, was excavated and developed, and nothing of evidentiary value was found.
Does anyone
Sounds
else
like a
find it
lazy theory? To me.
Yeah, anyone else find it strange that the police would believe that the body would be found right there, like someone abducted her and then buried her right there?
Yeah, like unless this was an employee who like buried her in the basement or something like that. What are you talking about? This sounds like a pick up the couch cushions kind of thing and see if you find, you know, a quarter.
Your car keys.
Like this. Yeah, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, unless I could foresee perhaps a situation in which Tika wandered out on her own and maybe was hit by a car on the road or in the parking lot, and I don't know. It doesn't seem like it seems like there was such an extensive search of the property where the bowling alley was on that they would have found something if there was anything to find. But as we know, nothing was found.
Right. And this was in the early 2000s, so a couple of years later. You don't just when you're redeveloping land, you don't just like stick a shovel in the ground and start going. Like, you have people out there surveying the land and marking off areas that they're digging. Come on. Like, if something was going to be found, it would have been found during the searches or during the exploration as they're getting ready to redevelop that land.
Yeah, I guess that is another one that kind of speaks to the hopelessness of the case. And
sure.
The police were sort of left with no answers there if they're, expecting her to be there at that point.
And verbalizing that, you know, whether they're verbalizing that to friends, family, or the media, they're still having those thoughts strong enough where they verbalize it.
And then in April of 2006, it is reported that a private investigator was hired by Tika's family, and they found a girl in Texas that may have been Tika. And Teresa sees a picture of the girl and believes that it is Tika, which you can imagine would be a pretty emotional moment. And the woman that was with the girl in the photo looks like someone that was at the bowling alley. And further investigation, though, reveals that the birthmarks do not match Tika, and DNA finally proved that this girl was not Tika.
So that's enough time, I think, to pass where a parent who's desperate to find their child might see similarities in a very similar-looking child who is now 7 years older and not seeing past the realities of, you know, the situation. Even seeing someone in the picture and saying that looks a lot like a person that was at the bowling alley that night. You know, like, people are very similar looking, especially years later.
Yeah, and I think grief definitely plays a part in this too. Grief can make you believe things that you otherwise wouldn't in a more reasonable way. state of mind. But I imagine for so long, like, I imagine going so long without any answers, you're kind of willing to stretch your imagination in any direction that would provide you answers.
For sure. Yeah, we back to that Donna Green interview that we had about missing Raymond Green. She had an experience very much like that. She thought there was a boy that was Raymond Green, turned out to not be him. And I would bet that in every case of a missing kid that there's a moment like this for the parent.
And Teresa still maintains that, at least in 2009, she stated that she believes Tika is alive and with one of her ex-boyfriends, one of Teresa's ex-boyfriends, and living with him in Florida. And it's a really interesting reason why she would believe this. Apparently, the man's mother, the ex-boyfriend's mother, had asked Teresa if she could have Tika before Tika disappeared. So she proposed that she takes Tika because she wanted to have a girl. And she didn't have a girl, a daughter. As a parent, again, is this a red flag?
I mean, yeah. I mean, unless there's like some scenario, I know they had a lot of kids, unless there's some scenario where you're not able to care for your children, you know, yeah, absolutely. This is a huge red flag.
And thankfully, Teresa told her no, said, quote, no way, she's my daughter. And she hasn't heard from the ex-boyfriend since March of 1999.
And it's not like this ex-boyfriend is Tika's father either. Like, can I just have your child? What kind of question is that?
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, this isn't an ex-boyfriend that is the father. This is an ex-boyfriend that was acquainted to Tika.
Yeah, and Teresa stated that she hadn't heard from this guy since March of 1999. Detectives stated that they did have a person of interest in 2009 in Florida and went there to speak to him. He was given two polygraphs, according to Teresa. He passed one and failed the other. It is not currently known if the police consider him a suspect at this time.
But they traveled all the way to Florida from Washington State to interview him twice, or at least once. He was given two polygraphs, apparently. So that's pretty compelling. And I assume this is the same person, Teresa's ex-boyfriend and the person they interviewed.
Yeah, we don't have like a clear confirmation from law enforcement that it's the same person, but like who else would it be in Florida?
It's really interesting. Do they ask the same questions on a polygraph if you pass it and then fail it? And is it known whether he failed it and then they gave it to him again and he passed it? Or did he pass and there was something about his behavior or something that made them give it to him again? Or we don't really know the order of the two, do we?
I mean, I think if he passed with flying colors, he probably wouldn't have been given a second one.
Yeah.
And I would bet that there are some repeat questions just to establish a baseline.
Yeah. So I guess what it would probably be, just using common sense, is that he failed it, or maybe something's lost in translation. Maybe it was inconclusive, so they gave him a second one. Or maybe he failed it and he asked for a second one and passed it. It's just interesting. I think I'm hung up on this because we don't see it very often where someone has two polygraphs and one's failed and one's passed. It's usually one's inconclusive and then one passed, or they're both inconclusive, or one failed, you know?
Right. I believe that's the case with Butch Atwood, though.
Yeah.
The bus driver who was the last person to see Maura Murray, he passed one and failed another, apparently, or it was at least inconclusive. I think failed and inconclusive are kind of the same thing when you're talking polygraphs.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, there are so many factors that go into polygraphing someone. I mean, especially if you did fail one and you are innocent, like, you would probably be quite emotional and quite anxious the second time you might pass one.
Yeah, I don't know if the, you know, police can really use the word failed, you know, publicly at least, because it just implies guilt, you know. So I think inconclusive they would tell the media or something like that. But internally they could definitely say, you know, this is guilty, this is suspicious as hell.
Yeah, I think of anything, polygraphs should not be viewed as a science. I know we've said this a million times, but they should be used as a psychological tool with a suspect.
On January 29th, 2010, it was reported that a man that attended that year's vigil approached Tika's family and told them that he had visions that Tika was buried in a garden at Point Defiance Park. And Teresa notified the police, who dug up the garden, which is, you know, I mean, I can't even believe
that's
they
amazing.
Followed. Yeah, but they did not find anything.
That's amazing. Isn't this amazing to you that She went to the police and said a man had a vision, and then they go into what I guess is a city-owned park and dig up a garden?
Yeah, I think that's sort of what we were talking about before. It's almost like akin to a confession if they were, you know what I mean? Like, I think they searched it because they thought this was maybe a suspect, not because they thought this guy was a great psychic and Tika's really there.
Amazing, though, that they even took it to that point instead of writing it off. You know, a suspect or somebody told this guy something, and that, you know, who knows why he did it, but I'm still just really, I mean, we're talking 11 years later.
Right. And do you think they brought cadaver dogs to the park first and they got a hit or something? Because it seems like just going right to digging based on a psychic tip is a bit extreme. So I would think they would bring dogs out first.
Yeah. I would imagine. I mean, they brought dogs out hours after the disappearance itself.
No, I think it's quite amazing that they dug up Point Defiance Park just on the basis of this guy's vision. And as we continue through this case, there are several other tips that the police took seriously. I think we're going to end here and come back in for part two as we dive deeper into Tika Lewis's disappearance.